All right, so we're going to look today just at the Second Vatican Council. So Pius XII was the previous pope. He dies, and so they have to elect a new pope. And so Cardinal Roncalli was elected, and he was elected on the 11th ballot. So that gives you some indication, right? And you all understand that black smoke, white smoke. So 10 times black smoke went up. They couldn't come to a consensus. And then the 11th time the smoke went up white, they had a new pope, and he took the name John the 23rd. Commented
that the 77-year-old had been elected as a transitional pope. It would allow the cardinals more time to determine what course they were supposed to follow. It was interesting, as I was preparing this week, I had a conversation with somebody about our new stated clerk, who we don't know yet, but I understand that the administrative committee has a man to present to us. And the person I was talking to said, yeah, my sense is that they're going to look for somebody around 60 so that it'll be a transitional stated clerk to sort of figure out where we are going. And it made me realize I am that man. I'm not going to be a stated clerk. I had no desire to do that job, none whatsoever. His brief pontificate, he was only pope for 5 years, 1958 to 1963, was marked, however, in the Roman Catholic Church, maybe by the most momentous change in the almost 2,000-year history of the Roman Catholic Church. His very decision to take the name John was significant because the previous two Pope Johns had done great things to soil the name of John. One of them was when there were three popes at the same time, one of them was that guy, and there was another who was, they called him the anti-pope. So if you can imagine, the previous two Johns had not been good candidates. And so by this cardinal taking on the name of John, it seemed to be an indication that this new pope was willing to break new ground. Because I think most people had assumed by this point in the late 50s that no, we wouldn't have any more Pope Johns. And he turned that upside down. He was viewed as a simple man. And because he was viewed as a simple man, it was believed that he wasn't going to really be up to the task of being pope. But interestingly, he gained profound wisdom and experience. He served as a bishop in Bulgaria, Istanbul, Turkey, and France. And living in those areas, what he began to understand was that the Roman Catholic Church particularly had cut itself off from communication with the world. Those were places that he often would not receive or hear word from the Roman Catholic Church. And so he was keenly aware of how the church could do a better job of communicating more broadly. And then the third really significant thing was 3 months after his election, he called an ecumenical council. And it's interesting, we're going to talk a lot about this ecumenical council, and we'll talk about why it's called ecumenical in a second. But all of us have been affected by the Second Vatican Council in some interesting ways. We'll look and dig through some of the documents. There were 16 of them. We won't look at all 16. He was convinced that the time had come for updating. In Italian, it was aggiornamento. Do I have that on the next? Yes. An updating, an adorning of the church. And he believed this could only be done through the combined wisdom and concerns of the bishops of the entire church. The Roman Catholic Church at this point had also come to the place where they wanted to keep most decisions in-house, which meant the Pope and his curia, which were his, for lack of a better word, lackeys, they were handpicked, you know, not that we ever see that in politics or anything, you know, but so he insisted that the wisdom of the broader church needed to be a part of this council, and it was going to it really did change the face of the Roman Catholic Church going forward. Even while they were preparing to start this council, the Pope issued an encyclical, Mater et Magistra, the mother of the magisterium, the mother of the church, if you will. And that's going to come into play a little bit later, which was taken up as a sort of a cry or a cause by many who were fighting for various issues of justice around the world and saw this encyclical as the Pope's blessing on their work. And that is also going to play. Many of you were alive. All of you were alive in the 50s, except me. and it was a tremendous period of change in the world. Certainly it was a tremendous period of change in the United States. We were seeing the rise of the civil rights movements were really gaining traction. Americans, particularly white Americans, were fleeing the cities to the suburbs. There were lots of transitions going on. I make the argument pretty regularly because we decry the 60s and the 70s. Those were interesting times. We wouldn't have had the 60s and 70s if we hadn't had the 50s. We wouldn't have had them. You know what I mean, John Kennedy.
Spock would say that's logical.
It is logical, yes. We wouldn't have had the implications of the 60s and 70s had we not had what went on in the 50s. Or even today when we decry the young generation, there are grandchildren and great-grandchildren. They didn't just pop up in a vacuum. and it's, you can't just say it's because of this, because it's never just because of this. It's because of this broad sort of cultural movement that's always moving, and it had an effect here on the church. So October 11th, 1962, seven weeks before I was born. All right, so this is not current history for me. Pope John opens the Second Vatican Council, and the documents prepared by the Curia, again, which are the it would be like the chiefs of staff and those kinds of people in a governmental setting. These were appointed by the Pope. They were significant men who were tasked with sort of the various ministries, if you will, of the church. And so the Curia begins to prepare documents, and all of their preparation simply was reaffirming traditional Catholic doctrine, because they were very conservative in terms of their view of the church. The Pope, however, while his Curia is preparing all these documents, is sort of working another tract, if you will, that would lead the council ultimately in a very, very different direction. In 1961, he created the Secretariat for the Promotion of Christian Unity. That office is still there in the Roman Catholic Church. I don't know who serves in it. I forgot to look that up. Not that you really care. But what it did was it showed his the seriousness with which he wanted to pursue agreement with other Christians. Now, who would the other Christians be? Us. Yes. The Second Vatican Council is going to open the door to, we're going to look when we get to the, when we look at the, particularly the evangelical church in the 80s, it's going to give rise to a broad effort in evangelicalism and Roman Catholicism to find some common ground. And we'll talk about that when we get there. So he's working the angles to make sure that he can hopefully get what he wants to accomplish in this council. In his opening speech, then, he indicates that it was time for the church to respond to the concerns of the modern world with words of understanding and encouragement rather than with blistering condemnations. If you read any of the documents from any of the previous councils, all the way back to the ones that we would say were good councils, what are they usually marked by? Blistering condemnations. Yeah, from Nicaea, who had to deal with Arius and that controversy. From Constantinople, where they're dealing with Nestorius. Alexandria, and they're dealing with Pelagius. I mean, most of the councils were reactive. And this really, well, even the Council of Trent, which we'll talk about in briefly, the Council of Trent was called in response to the Reformation. So all of those councils were sort of counteractive, and this is the first time that the church is calling a council to be proactive. And I chuckled when I read this, to respond to the concerns of the modern world. This is 1962. The modern world was almost done because we were almost ready to move into a postmodern world. All right, so and that is often typical of the church, is it not? We finally decide we're gonna address something and we're really, really late to the party. In fact, I would argue that the Reformation was a response to that at an appropriate time, because you had the Renaissance, sort of the birth of the modern era, if you will, and the Reformation was capturing the good things of it and really trying to reform the bad parts of it. The Roman Catholic Church, it took them 450 more years before they finally decided, hey, it's time to speak about the modern world. This was aided, and this is really why it was called an ecumenical council, although most councils had observers, but this one had more than most. It had, when it started, it had 31 non-Catholic observers, and by the closing session, it had 93. So there was a significant presence of non-Roman Catholic people.
I
didn't look at who was there, but I would. I don't know if some of the theologians of the time. None in the sort of conservative world would have been there. I'm trying to think when Karl Barth died. Barth may have been there, Karl Barth, who was a very influential theologian, and those kinds of people. But probably most of them we wouldn't have known. And a lot of them were from the rest of the world, not, you know. Contrary to Americans' belief, the world does not revolve around the United States. We sometimes have, and every country has that, right? Every country sort of is insular in the way that they sort of understand the world. And the Roman Catholic Church is not all that American. It's certainly the most global church. Did I see a hand? Yes. 68. Okay, so he may have been there. I don't know that. But he would have been one who would have been inclined to have been invited to that. He certainly had a broader view of the church. I'm fairly convinced that I will get to see Bart in heaven. I'm fairly convinced of that. Just because your theology isn't always great doesn't mean that you don't put your trust in Christ. Somebody asked me that last night. Somebody said, how do you give people assurance? And I said, it's hard. I mean, ultimately, it's the Holy Spirit that has to give you assurance. When I do funerals, I don't presume too much. How much did the thief on the cross know? Like nothing, right? All he knew was the man that was dying beside him on the cross was his only hope. And he looked in faith to Jesus. That's all he knew. So, you know, think about that. When the next time you want to you want to speak with blistering condemnations, we have to be very careful. That's not to say, well, even church discipline, which can come out with that sort of blistering condemnation. Jesus simply said, treat them as an unbeliever. And I think Jesus said, treat them as an unbeliever because we don't know whether they are or aren't. All we can do is look at a tree and say, okay, I see some good fruit on there. That's all we can do, right? But sometimes a tree may have a lot of bad fruit, but it may have some good fruit on it. And we aren't always perceptive enough because we don't know the heart, okay? That was free. All right, so of those delegates, 46% of the prelates came from Western Europe, Canada, and the United States, Western civilization. 42% came from Latin America, Asia, and Africa. And most of the African delegates came from what we would call Black Africa. We don't use that term today. But that just simply says, you know, Zimbabwe, South Africa, there weren't any representatives from those areas primarily. Many of the delegates came from very poor areas, so poor, in fact, that the council, the Second Vatican Council, had to establish a fund to pay for these men to come because they didn't have enough money to get there. That was back in the day where you were probably, especially if you were in Africa, you probably got on a ship, even in the 60s, and came across rather than flying. And they were very concerned about the plight of the poor. And that's often the case. I think, you know, when we read one of the, probably the most famous nun in this era was Mother Teresa. She was very concerned about the plight of the poor, and part of the reason she was concerned, and I think it shows her heart, is that what did she do? She went and lived among them. It's one thing for us to say, of course we care for the poor, but don't let any move into my neighborhood, or heaven forbid that I would actually move into their neighborhood, right? I have friends that they were a fairly young couple, three kids, really had a heart for the poor. So they bought a house in a drug-infested, crime-ridden neighborhood. And, you know, and their parents were just absolutely beside themselves. But they were willing to put their theology into action and go and be, you know, they went where they were. They didn't say, hey, we're here, come on, right? That's the modern-day approach to evangelicalism. And since that didn't work all that great, we make worship entertainment to hopefully lure some more people in. I mean, that's what we've done, rather than go, which I think Jesus said something about that. But anyway, the first document that they produced really was the most significant change, and it dealt with liturgy. I'm gonna show some quotes at the end from the various documents that you'll get to see. But here, liturgy renewal had been the concern of the previous pope, and so this was something that was already in the works. The conservative minority, again, most of them in the curia of the papacy, tried to block these changes, right? Why would we do anything differently? Why would we do anything differently? You know, not that we would ever have that attitude. It's easy for us to always, I mean, I think of that when I'm coming out of my neighborhood and I turn right. I think, I meant to turn left. But I turned right because I always turn right. Yeah, I always turn right. So we get into those things without thinking much, all right? And certainly when it comes to change is hard. Change can be painful, but change is necessary. Because if you're not changing, you're dying. And that's certainly true of the church, certainly true of the church. And I think the Roman Catholic Church understood that. But this small minority wanted to block the changes, but ultimately updating the liturgy won the day. And once the conservative element was defeated, most of the succeeding documents were then sent back, because they were all from a conservative perspective, they were all sent back to be rewritten with a more progressive view in the church. Pope John didn't live to see even that first document of the council put forward. He died in June of 1963, so not long after the council started. The next pope took the name Paul. He didn't live very long. Not Paul. There's another one after that. Sorry, I'm in the wrong one. Paul the Sixth. So he takes the name Paul. And this associates him with the pope that oversaw the Council of Trent. Again, the Council of Trent was called to respond to the Reformation. It really was the counter-reformation, of the Roman Catholic Church. Although, if you read the documents of the Council of Trent, there wasn't a whole lot of reformation in those documents. It was simply a reaffirmation of, hey, what we're doing is okay. Yeah, maybe we made a few mistakes, and so they address, you know, indulgences to a degree, although indulgences continue even today, those sorts of things. When he took the name Paul, which would associate him with the pope that oversaw the Council of Trent, conservatives hoped that he would just simply come in, dissolve the council, and be done, because they thought he was their man, or at least hinder significant changes. Paul the Sixth, who was 1963 to 1978, immediately declared his intention to continue the work. So as soon as he's elected pope, he says, we're going to continue, which marked... I don't know ultimately why he took the name Paul, but it may have been to satisfy some of the malcontents in his circles, but he was really committed to the changes that John had been committed to prior to him. When the second session opened on September 29th, 1963, he called those present to build a bridge between the church and the modern world. So again, he's reflecting that spirit that John had brought and is now continuing, that the church, and this is always a challenge for the church. How do you, and Jesus sort of alluded to this a couple of times, when he's, you know, how do you live in the world but not be of the world? I mean, we understand that's what we're called to do, but doing it is a whole different matter, because the world finds the cracks in us, doesn't it? And it seeps in places and ways that we aren't even aware of. And our thinking gets affected, all right? So the constitution of the sacred liturgy, the first document, is the most tangible result of the second session, and it would soon make an impact among the Catholic Church around the globe. It had the most impact in terms of that. It authorized the use of the vernacular to a degree not permitted before. So... if any of you grew up Roman Catholic, there was a day in 1965 where all of a sudden the Mass was not in Latin anymore. Do you remember that? Yeah. It was like that the church flipped because of this document. Do you remember services in Latin?
Because I went to Catholic school. We had to go to church. I don't even remember. I don't think we went every day. I think we went 3 days a week. And all of a sudden, before that.
Yeah, it was just gibberish. Yeah. So it was a significant change. It opens, that document on the liturgy opens with, as long as the essential unity of the Roman rite is preserved, in the revision of the liturgical books, steps shall be taken for proper variations and adaptations according to the needs of various groups, regions, and peoples, particularly in mission territories. Do I have that? Yes, there. This, interestingly again, so this is 65, sorry. Where are we? 1963. This is what the Reformation was about. Was maintaining the integrity of worship, but doing it in a way that would speak to the people in their own language. Because prior to that, if you translated the scriptures into your own language, if they caught you, you would be burned at the stake. That's just the way it was. So again, you have to put this in that context and understand how monumental this was. All right. Or that's right. If you happen to die before we caught you, we'll dig your bones up and burn those. Yes. Yes. The thing.
It's all about control.
No Roman Catholic leader ever would say it's about control. I would argue it is about, at some level it's about control, but part of it is because the leadership in the Roman Catholic Church had a great distrust for the laity. They simply viewed the people, the common people, as illiterate, ignorant, stupid. And so in order to preserve the integrity, we just have to keep things the same. Yep, Randy.
And they come in for a lot of criticism, which is valid, but they were also writers. there wasn't a public school system like we have. And there was great danger in the prospect of turning the word loose among people who had no formal training or understanding.
Yes. It did. That's exactly right. Well, and the Anabaptist movement, particularly in Reformation churches, grew out of laity. There's always the challenge that the laity has been called priests to God. We believe in the universal priesthood of all believers. At the same time, the Bible is very clear that God gives gifts to the church. And what is the first gift that we understand it to be? Well, after the Spirit. The Spirit gives gifts. So, it's the teaching ministries of the church. Because there is a level of response. I'm going to be judged far more severely than any of you. Far more severely. Some men don't seem to care about that. That's another story altogether. So Paul's admonition to Timothy is to study to show yourself approved, a workman of God. So study is important, and I have the best job in the world. I get paid to study and pray. I do. And you have an obligation to hold me accountable to those things. I don't know how I got down this road. How did I go down this? Oh, that's okay. That's now I remember. So the Roman Catholic Church did understand that. I mean, in my class this past summer, one of the we were reading Christian mystics throughout the ages, and a lot of them were laity, and so some of them were desert. They lived out in the desert as hermits, and they had some interesting views.
Not just control, but also they came up through a system that a significant portion of their faith was rooted into tradition.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
You don't change tradition.
That's right, exactly. If salvation is found only in the church, then the primary obligation is to maintain the integrity of the church. Right. Rather than, we would argue, that the integrity doesn't reside in the church, it resides in the Word. And so the integrity of the Word has to be maintained. And the Roman Catholic Church hasn't had that view for a very, very, very long time. All right, we're not going to, well, maybe. By the way, if you're in choir, you don't have to go today because we're not singing. So, the third session ran from September 13th to November 21st, 1964, and the council issued documents on the church, the Eastern churches, and ecumenism. Many at the council sought to emphasize, and this was interesting to me, they sought to emphasize the centrality of Christ and to counteract the extremes that had grown up in the church over devotion to Mary. So the Roman Catholic Church understood that there were many who had gone to excesses in the devotion of Mary. I'll show you an interesting tidbit in a moment. And yet the Pope, on his own initiative, declared the Virgin to be the mother of the church. So if she's the mother of the church, then, well, we're gonna elevate our... all my Roman Catholic friends remind me, we don't worship Mary. I said, well, why do you talk to her? Well, she's an intermediary. I said, no, that's why God sent Jesus. I don't need another one, right? She was blessed by God, and we are to esteem her because she was blessed by God, but that's the extent of it, all right? The fourth and final session was gathered from September 14 through December 8, 1965. Most of the debate revolved around religious freedom, and these were bitter debates. Many of the conservatives who were from nations where Roman Catholicism was the majority, they were in complete control, they didn't like this, because we don't like the thought that other non-Roman Catholics can do certain things. Of course, you can imagine the American contingent, especially on this one, all right? Maybe the hallmark of our Constitution is religious liberty. Once the last attempt by these conservatives failed, the opposition collapses and the rest of the session saw more progressive elements come into this final session. The most significant were the documents on religious freedom and another one on the church in the modern world, and we'll look at those momentarily. The most significant of these was the Pastoral Constitution on the Church in the Modern World. It was the longest document ever produced by a council in the whole history of the Roman Catholic Church. It's long. It insisted on Catholic principles of faith and morality, but it showed an openness towards the positive aspects of modernity, deals creatively with family life, economic and social issues, politics, technology and science, significant and variety of human cultures. I mean, there are lots, that's why it's so long. And it's interesting to see them interacting with those sorts of things. It begins, "The joys and hopes, the griefs and anxieties of people of our time, particularly of those who are poor or in any way afflicted, are the joys and hopes, the griefs and anxieties of Christ's followers." Amen. Theirs is a community of people, people who, in union with Christ and with the guidance of the Holy Spirit, move forward towards the kingdom of the Father and carry the message of salvation intended for all. For this reason, this community knows that it is deeply united with humankind and its history. We can never forget that all mankind is made in the image of God. And the Roman Catholic Church, there are a couple of things that Roman Catholic Church does really well, and that's one of them, is they affirm that every single human being is made in the image of God. So that's their attempt here. In some areas, change was resisted, while in others, in terms of the implementation of it. So in some areas where these changes come, they're simply, we're not going to do that. You can't tell us what to do, right? While in others, it was so rapid, the change, that the church had to take measures to try to stem it, to moderate those changes. So in 1968, the Pope issues Humanae Vitae, an encyclical that banned all methods of artificial birth control, all of them, overruling a papal commission that recommended the admission of some methods of birth control. So most of the Roman Catholic families that I knew, they had many children. Yeah, some of you are part of those many children, right? You know, if you didn't have eight kids, there was obviously something wrong. And that's just the way it was. The Roman Catholic Church still officially has that position, although it has moderated significantly. Although it came into play with Obamacare, when Obamacare, part of that was you have to provide for contraceptive use, and certain Roman Catholic groups sort of objected to that, okay? Yeah, well, because part of Obamacare, part of the world that we live in's view of contraception is abortion, and that was the part that Protestants. Oh, certainly, and I think the evangelical church tried. I'm not sure that they effectively did it. The Protestant church should have taken a much harsher stance against IUDs, for example, because they don't prevent pregnancy. They prevent the fertilized egg from attaching to the wall of the uterus, which is abortion. Yeah, it is. That's okay. I lost my place again. Da, 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 da. Oh, yes. Okay. Paul VI dies in 1979, and after a brief pontificate by John Paul I, I don't know if you blinked, you missed him. He was not Pope very long. John Paul II was elected, and he's the man that most of us remember. And in many ways, more than any other Pope in history, was revered by many in the evangelical world. Part of that was because he was the first non-Italian Pope elected since the 16th century. So it had been a long time. He was from Poland, and so he knew the struggle of the church under both German fascism and Russian communism. So he had no illusions about either of those. He didn't think either one of those were good or healthy for governments. And so his pontificate was marked by growing tensions in Poland, especially between communist government and the Roman Catholic Church. And part of that was sort of fueled by the fact that the Roman Catholic Church named one of them as their new pope. It was a shot by the Roman Catholic Church against communism. And interestingly, I think the communists understood the significance of it much more than most other people did. Because John Paul II then befriends a labor worker by the name of Lech Walesa, who turned the communist world upside down. It was probably his work in Poland that really opened the door for ultimately the fall of the Berlin Wall and all of those things. So it's really significant to think, and again, that's why you can sit there and say, well, why are we talking about the Roman Catholic Church? Because we've been impacted by the Roman Catholic Church in lots of different ways, and one of them was a significant change in the world that we live in. Yes, John.
Was the Roman Catholic Church involved with helping a lot of the Nazis get out of Germany? I heard they were.
I don't know that. My suspicion would probably be that they were not. And if they were, they were probably no more complicit than the Lutherans who were also helping to get them out of Germany. And part of that, and again, for we look and we say, this was evil, right? But when evil is a friend, it changes the way that we deal with people. When there's, you know, we can talk about the plight of drug addiction, but when your son or daughter is involved in that, it changes it. I had a long chat last night with Rachel Kramer. Her sister, youngest baby in the family, is an absolute train wreck. Absolute train wreck. Lost her children last year. The state came in and took them away because she couldn't take care of them. And Rachel was, you know, she loves her sister, and yet this awfulness that is there. And so again, it's hard for us to sort of think about how we would react. And, you know, I hear all the time, well, if my son ever came home and said he was gay, well, let's see how that works out. Because frankly, we don't know how we're going to respond. And what does it mean to love them, but at the same time not condone their behavior, right? Yes, I'll get to you. Andy?
Yeah, officially, the Catholic Church was neutral. There were Catholics within Germany that helped.
Oh, absolutely. But again, I would argue no more than the Lutheran Church or, you know, others, you know. Scott?
I mean, you're a white man, so you're evil.
in today's society, that's certainly true. That's certainly true to a certain extent. Again, what we do is we take a small minority, and it is a small minority even in our culture, who has a very loud voice, and we've allowed them to have much more influence than they ought. A majority of people still are fairly conservative, even in the United States. It's just that most of those fairly conservative folk aren't in the places of power or position. And so, we are absolutely 100% complicit in this. We have handed over the keys to the culture, to our children, to our grandchildren, to public education in its many different forms. And now we wonder why on earth our kids are the way they are. Well, we've been sending them to the temple of the secular humanism for decades and decades and decades. I mean, I hear parents all the time, well, I turned out okay. We're all affected by things that we don't even think about. We don't. We sort of just take them for truth, whether it was true or not. I mean, you know, I learned all about Darwinian evolutionary theory, which now they don't teach anymore because Darwin was stupid. It's different now. Darwin at least had some. There was a place for God even in evolutionary, which is why some of the late 19th century Christian theologians embraced a theistic evolutionary view. now we're just completely secular, and our children are being sacrificed in this country. They are, not just through abortion, but through. Not that I have strong opinions on this, by the way. And I lived in that world. I had a dream last night that I went back to teaching band. I guess it was because I was having a conversation. And it was a nightmare to me. And I loved what I did, but public education just, it wasn't about education. It was about power, manipulation, politics. It was all about those things. It wasn't about teaching. It wasn't about teaching. Yeah, I just saw one of the most popular classes now in college is a basic homemaking 101. And it's sad, but the reason that that's there is because the family has been torn apart since the late 50s. Again, it's our fault. It's our fault. Absolutely. That's exactly right. Yeah, I mean, my two daughters-in-law don't work outside the home, and they're like pariahs. Like, how does that work, right? All right, I need to stop. We're not going to get to our... We'll look at next week. We'll look at the various documents. Any other thoughts? Yeah, Randy. Mm-hmm.
Was primarily done by people who were
committed Catholics. Correct.
They were members of the aristocracy. Aristocracy in Germany was primarily Catholic. But for instance, von Stauffenberg was a devout Catholic and Christian principles, in addition to just the cultural thing of being a member of the aristocracy.
Right.
So, Catholics were on both sides of the...
That's right. And I think that that's ultimately...
Catholic official, I think.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, in fact, the band that Bonhoeffer was tied up with was primarily Roman Catholic. It's hard to paint any group with a broad brush. Any group with a broad brush. Even a small assembly like ours has great diversity within it. And we need to remind ourselves of that regularly. Okay? All right, I need to stop. I went... way over. Let's pray. Lord, thanks. Thank you for